Should I light my candle, Rebecca?
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry. Let's light our candles.
That's okay.
And it does feel like you're coiled a little tight. And so invite your breath into your heart space. Don't try to push it. Just open it up a little.
These are the sounds of a tarot reading I did in early January with Rebecca Aumann, professional witch. In the months leading up to this, I'd been listening to a podcast she hosts called Voices in the River. Initially, I was drawn to her warmth and her North Carolina accent. And then I realized, oh, I need this. I was in this sort of manic life management mode as I tried to sort out the future of this show and also what my job could look like. And so when I heard around year's end that Rebecca does these year-ahead readings for people, I reached out to see if we could do one together and record it.
Are you a heady person?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes. Do you focus mostly on your intellect?
Yes.
Your body is really tight.
Yeah, I've been exercising a lot, but I'm, like, doing a lot of, like, strength stuff that, like, push-ups, which aren't, like, loosening necessarily.
Yeah, you're efforting.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to consider flow and surrender.
Flow and surrender are not my usual modes. I have something I call producer brain, which means I like to plan and strategize and report my way through uncertainties. It's this idea that if I enlist the right expert, track down the right research, and put in the work, I can figure it out.
Right now, I mean, I can feel the heaviness. Mm. You have time and this yummy space. So when you're afraid, instead of withdrawing, it's important to say, hey, friends, I'm afraid. Can we get together and talk about this? Because I think part of what has happened is that you've held space for so many, and it's hard to shift so that you're being held.
After my reading, Rebecca sent me pictures of all the cards she pulled for my upcoming year. And I was left thinking, I need to know more about this woman. What is it like to move through life being able to pick up on so much from other people, even over Zoom? And I wanted to know whether her intuitive gifts had helped her through her own life decisions.
When nothing else works, that's when you call a witch.
This is Death, Sex, and Money. The show from Slate about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. About 6 weeks after my Zoom tarot reading with professional witch Rebecca Aumann, we got on a video call again, this time for me to interview her. And just like the first time, she was immediately observant.
Your jaws are much better.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Huh.
Yeah, there's some fluid there.
I had been trying to hold my shoulders and face more loosely since our reading. It also helped that when we connected the next time, I was duly employed again, having just gone through HR orientation at Slate. Rebecca gets people like me. Type A people who use Zoom for HR orientations and for psychic readings. She made me feel transparent, my wobbly parts so plain to see. When we talked about her life, I learned that hasn't always transferred over into seeing herself so clearly. Starting as a kid, Rebecca focused her gifts of attunement on others. And now that she's a professional tarot card reader, her lifelong friends say that tracks.
They are always like, oh, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Like, we always knew. Like, you always knew. You always blurted. You always said things that shouldn't be said or knew things that shouldn't be known.
You were like the junior high school student who would help all the teenagers figure out how to make things happen.
I can do a manifest spell. I always, it's so funny that I ended up being a fundraiser because, yeah, I'm all about manifesting.
For you, do you believe you have a gift of understanding and affecting things in a magical realm, Or do you understand it more as being able to tune in to frequencies that others miss?
I think about my intuition like I think about the moon. So people say she's always full, yet sometimes she's in shadow. Mm. And I do feel like I have an ability to see what's in the shadows. Mm-hmm. And when I'm with people, I just know what questions to ask, mm-hmm. like to provoke them to understand their own knowing. I think there's different frequencies, and everyone has them. Some have a more linear strategic frequency, and I just happen to have a more intuitive frequency.
I like that.
You know, if you're my friend and I call you and I say, I'd like to go to lunch, they're like, oh my God, here it comes. And so we'll go to lunch. And I just had lunch with a friend of mine, and she was like, I couldn't decide if I'd done something wrong last night when we went to this show and you were upset about that, or you were going to give me a message. And so I say, I have a piece of information that I think would help you, but I think it's going to bump you. Are you okay with that?
Oh, I love that. Do you ever have people say, I don't want to be bumped today? Let's do it next week.
I do, actually. I mean, people who know me really well are just like, you know what? Not today. Call me tomorrow.
Wow. I was just listening to a Paul Simon song this morning called Father and Daughter. Do you know it?
I don't.
There's this line that stuck out to me that I thought you might like, because for me, sometimes when people say trust your intuition, I don't know what that means.
Right.
And he's a line in that song says, trust your intuition. It's just like going fishing. You cast your line and hope you get a bite. And I thought,
I like it.
Oh, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I think it's about paying attention to that voice that is not an outside voice. And we've all had it, like at certain points in our life. And it's like, how do you practice it? You have to show up for your intuition so it can trust you. And then you can trust it.
I like that. Whether it's like sitting at a desk or like the visual of like casting a fishing line, it's like such a small movement, but it's like I'm indicating that I'm open.
Yeah, I have a chair that my friends call the big thought chair. And when I sit in that chair and I light a candle, you know, when I sit in the chair, I light a candle and I pull a card. Like, it's like, okay, game on. Come on. Come on. Be with me.
Mm-hmm. It's so like host-oriented.
Well, you know, the intuition loves to be adorned. They like to be celebrated. Our voices are so cast aside that it's just like, will you open the door for just a second? Will you sit down in the chair? Will you sit on this rock? Will you step into the river so I can find you?
Trust your intuition. It's just like going fishing. You cast your line and hope you get a bite.
Water metaphors are big with Rebecca. Again, her podcast is called Voices in the River. She told listeners initially when she had the idea, she talked herself out of it, that the world didn't need another podcast. But then she said a friend told her, I think you should just throw some voices in the river
and see what happens. And I began to think about how powerful that image was and how I feel. I'm so committed to helping women unearth their power and to disrupt narratives about women, power, magic. And so I thought, oh yeah, let's just throw some voices in the river and see if a shift occurs.
Just throwing stuff out, seeing what catches, accepting that you have a role to play but aren't in charge of what becomes of it all. It's a kind of faith that for Rebecca came from having a kind of knowing that she couldn't explain. Sometimes this knowing is just a subtle sense. Sometimes it comes as clear information. Like once when she was a kid in her Methodist church where her father was the minister.
And he was standing at the front of the church in his long black robe, and he would call out a Bible, a chapter and a verse, and we were to find it in our Bibles. And before he would speak it, I could see it come out of his head. Hmm. And so I would find the things first before anybody else, which I was very excited about that. But my mother, she came to get me. I think she saw what was happening and took me to a Sunday school class and sat me down and said, "You must never do that again." And so I stopped. Hmm. And I really, I don't know that I experienced it again until I was 29.
So Rebecca shelved her intuitive gifts, and her inner voice started to get a little tangled up with the voices of her parents.
It was really important to my parents that I be a good example and that I be a leader. And so I did a lot of striving and a lot of performing without really thinking about it. So yeah, I think that's what I thought about. I thought about, gosh, I want to be president of the United States. And I'm going to be a leader. I'm going to rule the world. I think that's where I was.
I'm familiar with the type.
Yes, I know. A lot of us are familiar with the striving. I wanted to be a good girl for Jesus' sake.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Was it about Jesus and about how to be good?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
What was good and true got more confusing as Rebecca became a teenager and other bodily messages started coming through. I want to talk about summer camp and your first romances.
Oh my gosh, Cameron. He told me he was going to make me talk about love.
Producer Cameron.
Okay, so when I was 13,
okay,
I went to church camp and my roommate, or maybe my sweet mate, was another preacher's daughter. And she was reading, she's a year older than I am, and she was reading Ruby Fruit Jungle, which is a lesbian novel by Rita Mae Brown that everyone read in the 70s.
Oh, that is a way to seduce, to be on like a camp cot reading Rita Mae Brown.
The second I saw her, I was like, oh my gosh, I love you. And this was in the 70s. I mean, you had to write letters. Mm-hmm. And we would write love letters to each other. I remember sitting in my bedroom and I would just wait for the mail to come. And I would know when her letter landed and I would go and get it. So yeah, we had a love affair from that time through, well, I mean, we went our separate ways, but then we had a love affair when I was in my 20s. We had a love affair when I was in my 30s. We had a love affair when I was in my 40s. I don't know that I should say this, but it was a long time ago. Then I was invited back after I graduated because I was such a leader. I was invited back to be the dean of women, and I was caught in bed with her as the dean of women, which was scandalous.
Do you think, I want to go back to when you first, like, noticed each other. In the way you experience it, when you have a connection with someone and it feels like, you know, sometimes we call it a crush or sometimes we call it, like, chemistry, like, does that magnetism, do you think that's the same thing as intuition or is it different?
You know, I'm a person who thinks I have excellent intuition about other people. I don't necessarily have good intuition about me.
Oh.
And so those kinds of situations, magnetism, love, intimacy, those are about me and my intuition. And so it's taken me a while to feel like I can trust that. I mean, now I would say I can. Then I would say I was kind of a disaster.
Disaster?
Yeah. So it would be kind of hard for me to say intuition and magnetism are the same, just because for me, I'm kind of psychically dyslexic when it comes to relationships.
And why do you say that?
A lot of times what I think is true isn't true.
Mm.
And I think it's almost like it's too close. You know, there's like this mirror and I just get all turned around. I mean, I can sit with somebody and see so clearly what the path is. But, you know, I think any of us, have a hard time doing it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's come with, for me, with practice and age, but certainly in my early love affairs, I never got it right.
Or you were exploring as opposed to wrong and right. You were collecting information.
I was collecting a lot of information from a lot of different people who may not have had my best interest at heart.
Getting to know Rebecca now, in her late 50s, it's hard to picture this less certain version of her. But she says it's always been easier to see others more clearly than herself, especially when she was younger. Coming up, the two life events that shaped her early adulthood, her mother's death and getting married to a man. Hey, I want to take a minute to say thank you again for the incredible welcome back messages we've been getting since we relaunched with Slate last week. We also heard from listeners who found us for the first time, and I want to say welcome. Death, Sex, and Money is an interview show hosted by me, but we also like to treat this show like a clubhouse where people are invited in to listen and also say their piece. We heard from a lot of you about our episode last week about sociopaths. I talked about some of your reactions over on Instagram. You can find us there at Death, Sex, Money. And we also have been listening to the life advice questions many of you have sent in. A few of my Slate colleagues joined me to listen and think about the really varied collection of big life transitions you're in the middle of, from what to do immediately post-college, all the way to how to fill your time in retirement. And you'll hear that episode next week. In the meantime, I wanted to share another question that one of our listeners is struggling with to see if some of you had some ideas.
I am trying to decide whether to move out of my home and either move back across country to where I used to live or somewhere else in my metro area. I got out of an abusive relationship 4 years ago, but unfortunately, I still have to see the person because he's the father of my son. In any event, I'm realizing that this home has memories I don't know that I'll ever be able to get away from. It's a nice home. Moving's hard, but it's a big quandary I've been thinking about. I'd love advice. Thanks.
Have you ever had to continue to live in a space that had heavy memories? How did you change it up? Or do you think that's impossible and you'd advise this listener to prioritize finding a new place to live? The other question in here is, how do you make decisions about where you have to live and feel good about it when you have to co-parent with someone else? If you have stories or advice to share with this listener, send them to us at deathsexmoney@slate.com. You can write an email or record a voice memo, and we'll share them with this listener, and I'll share them back with you in my newsletter. If you are not getting that weekly newsletter yet, you can sign up at annasale.substack.com. All that info is also in the show notes. We love being in touch with you, and we love making this show with you. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. I'm Anna Sale. Just a few years after Rebecca Allman was chastised in church by her mother to not mention things Rebecca knew that others couldn't see, her mother became ill.
She got sick when I was 10, and then she died when I was 19.
How do you describe how you coped with grief at that time in your life?
I was heartbroken. I mean, I just think when you're in college and you're trying to figure out your sexuality and you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life and you don't really understand the religion in which you grew up, and then your mother dies, it's a tower moment and you have to restructure old forms. And I think only now do I realize the impact it had on me. Now that my friends who are I'm 58, so their parents are now dying. Mm. And I'm like, oh, like I was really young.
Yeah. A tower moment is what you said. What do you mean by tower moment?
Oh, gosh. In Tarot, there's a major arcana card that's called the Tower. And it's really like a lightning strike. Hmm. And it tears the tower to the ground and you have to rebuild. So that's the most dramatic interpretation. It can also just be disorientation. And I think I was just so disoriented by grief.
Hmm.
And I think being in love with women, I went to a women's college. It was Baptist college. You know, I just was like, oh my gosh, I'm just wrong on every count.
At your college, was it okay to be with women if it, like...
No, it was a Southern Baptist, very conservative. And I wanted to go to a Northeastern women's college. And my mother said, oh, no, you can't because there's a bunch of lesbians there. And I thought, oh, my gosh, well, they're going to be lesbians where I'm going too. But yeah, no, it wasn't okay.
Uh-huh. And so for you... Was it this idea of like, if I can fold this part of me up inside and not?
You know, I don't know that it really bothered me. And I dated men and women, but then it must have on an unconscious level because I got married. And all my friends are like, what? And he was he was a nice guy. But yeah, I just should have never gotten married.
How old were you when you married?
28.
Uh-huh.
So I'd had some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just felt like there wasn't an option. Like it had been so embedded in me that you get married and you have kids and you do the thing. And I bought it, although I didn't. So that's a conundrum.
And when you married and thought about what kind of work was ahead of you, when you're 28, 29, what were the building blocks of your life at that point?
We were the party house, so a lot of people came to our house. We had all the wild parties. We had a fire pit. My husband was a great bartender. We did a lot of swing dancing, like we danced. I mean, we just had wild parties.
And this is in where was this?
North Carolina.
Okay.
Durham, North Carolina. Like my 33rd birthday, we had this amazing party. But, you know, like I threw my back out because I was doing back handsprings in the backyard, which you should not be doing when you're 33.
Yes. Yes. And you also said that it was around 29 when you felt the gift reemerge that you'd stuffed away when you were a third grader. Mm-hmm. How did it reappear?
I think I was on the board of the Lesbian and Gay Health Project, and the executive director, a fabulous man, had gone maybe to a witch camp in Michigan. And
okay, hang on. Is it actually called Witch Camp?
I think it is called Witch Camp.
Okay, that's amazing.
I've hosted a Witch Camp, but I think this is called Witch Camp. It may not. I have no idea. But essentially Witch Camp. You can imagine what happens there. And he brought back these cards, and he was like, I want to read your tarot cards for you. And I think it was the first week of March, and I gave birth on the 14th day of March. So I was very pregnant, and... he did this reading for me. I don't even know what it said, but it was like the women from the cards came out of the cards and stayed with me all night. They talked to me. They showed me things.
Wow.
I mean, I could not let it go. And I ordered a deck, and I thought, oh my gosh, I have to find a place in my house. And it was a very small house, you know, and I was getting ready to have a baby. So my poor husband, I was so pregnant, and I was like, you have to tear out the pantry right now and make it a magic room. And so and of course, I couldn't do anything. So he tears out the pantry, bless his heart, and makes me a magic room. That's love. When you are about to give birth in 2 weeks and you want your pantry torn out, that's love. And so, I created this magic room, and I started studying the cards, not studying them. I just knew what they said. And I started calling other mediums, intuitives, readers, and asked them for readings and learned what I could from them. And it just went from there.
Whoa. And that's like in the weeks before you have a child?
Yes. 2 weeks before. Maybe a week. I mean, I was, yeah, it was the same time.
Did it feel, when you were giving birth, I don't know what your experience of birth was, but did you feel accompanied by these people you had been, you'd called in?
You know, I did not want, when it came right down to it, I did not want to give birth. In fact, this teeny tiny nurse had to grab me and say, do it now. I mean, I was like, oh, no, I'm not ready. I did actually think I was going to have a very spiritual birth. Like, I brought candles, and I was going to do the water thing, and it was going to be so beautiful. And I'm sorry for all these people getting ready to give birth, but it hurts like freaking hell. And there's no time for any of that. There's no time for ritual or beauty or calm. It's just not, it was not that way for me. So, they were not with me. I was just screaming and yelling. Maybe they were, but I was not talking to them. I was yelling expletives.
I just am noticing this contrast of like, I'm certain we cannot have a pantry anymore. It is my new magic room and it has to happen right now. And then you're like 40 weeks pregnant and you're like, this baby, it's not time yet.
It's not time. No, I do have control issues. Yeah. I still do. I'm still that person.
So in your life, when you were 33, you said, I want something in this marriage has to change. I need to end this marriage.
It might have been later than that, because when I first showed up and said, I want a divorce, he was like, we can figure this out. Like, yes, as you know, divorces are processes.
A divorce is indeed a process. Something that comes at the end of considering what changes a marriage can hold and what it can't. Since her marriage, Rebecca's been in a number of long-term relationships with women, though she's single now. And throughout, she worked a lot. Coming up, when she realized that needed to change.
I couldn't go anymore. I was vice president at this organization, and I decided to leave. And I left on 11-11 at 11.
Rebecca Allman was around 40 when her divorce was final. And it was just one in a series of big life ruptures.
I got divorced, my father died, and I decided I needed to move 3,000 miles away from home.
I see.
Which I did for 13 years.
Rebecca left North Carolina and started a new life on the West Coast. She worked as a fundraiser for healthcare institutions, and she was really good at that job. She says her ability to read people really came in handy. But after a decade, the work started to feel exhausting. She decided to take some time off without really knowing what was next.
I walked on the beach every day. I ate something green every day. I took a nap every day. Those were my goals the first year.
Then she started her own coaching business and really leaned into her intuitive side. But a few years in, something still felt off.
I lived in a beautiful place, but I just needed some people and some sunshine, and I came back home. And for a long time, I thought coming home was kind of failing. But it's been just the most generative, beautiful, expansive time. And I'm so grateful to the people who welcomed me back.
Why did it feel like failing to come home?
I think I thought I didn't need anybody. I'm old to be learning that lesson. But I really just thought I could do it all by myself.
Oh.
And yeah, so coming home was kind of admitting that I needed people. And I needed people who loved me, who saw me. Yeah. And in Oregon, I just worked. I mean, I was just a boss, you know. And I had really good people with whom I worked. But, you know, I worked with them. And I worked so hard, I didn't have time for friends. And nobody really knew me. I remember going out to dinner with somebody and thinking, oh my gosh, I haven't had like a regular dinner where I didn't have a brief and an agenda in 30 years.
Oh.
Yeah. And so coming home was like admitting, gosh, I need people, I need friends, I need love.
This was Rebecca's moment of realizing in midlife, her familiar ways of doing things were not going to work anymore. During my reading with Rebecca, she nudged me to a similar conclusion when she pulled a card that I tell you was scary looking.
What crosses you is the Ten of Swords.
That looks like a lot of swords, Rebecca.
It's a lot of swords. It's all the swords. It's all. And swords are about the intellect. It's uh-huh. the element of air. And this card is literally the fear of ruin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the stories we tell ourselves. The fear that comes from your head and the narratives that you're telling yourself about that are not productive.
Yeah.
So like, this is a heart process.
Yeah.
And you can't really make it a head process. Hmm. So I wanted to see what card was underneath because I wanted you to have a little hope. And you got the Six of Swords. And the Six is about safe passage through the water and through all those swords. There are also three people in this card.
Mm-hmm.
So there is little Anna, adult Anna, and your guide. Mm-hmm. And so what you've sort of pushed aside is your wholeness. You've split yourself into different parts to fit everything.
Mm-hmm.
And what the calling is for you to bring all those things back together.
The safe passage is telling me that I can let up a
yes.
little.
Mm-hmm. It can be effortless. Congruence is effortless.
Did you hear that? That's Rebecca telling me that the ways I think I'm helping myself with busyness, to-do lists, making order, and clamping down on uncertainty, that can actually be unproductive. She's trying to get my type A side to let me unfurl, take time, need help, loosen my clenching jaw. Having her pick cards for me helped me with that. Sort of. Because I can't always tell what my body is telling me. There's that question of like, if something deep in your body is inflamed and telling you to abort mission, it can be really confusing to know whether that's fear or whether that's a guiding thought you should trust. And I know it's not a simple answer, but if somebody comes to you with that question of just, you know, my body seems to be telling me something really clearly, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's something I need to comfort and push through or listen to.
We often create time and space to meet it. Like, what is the color and texture of the feeling in your body? And can we go on a journey or a meditation there to explore it and ask questions of it? I don't have the answer, but certainly that feeling in your body does. And I think when feelings in bodies get louder, it's like, pay attention to me. I have something to tell you. And I do think through guided meditation, shamanic journeys, journal prompts, you can come to understand what's there. I can't tell you, but I can lead you to your own conclusion about what that is. I also think sometimes when you don't know, you just don't know, and it's not time yet.
Mm. That can be a hard lesson for people who are student council leaders.
Well, and let me just say, women who are working and are mothers, that is super hard. Like, I'm at a different life stage, so I understand that what I'm saying is absolutely insane. But if you can take 5 minutes or even a minute, like with my son when he was little, we would put on classical music and I would light candles and I would set a timer for 5 minutes. I was like, we're just going to lie here for 5 minutes and have special time. And he still talks about it. But it was just like time for me to just chill out for a second.
I love that it's just called special time.
Oh my gosh. Special time with music and candles.
You know what I'm instituting starting day one right here? Special time in my household when my kids come over from school.
5 o'clock. Now, I must say, I might have had a cocktail before special time.
Yeah, that's okay. Special drink for special time. That's okay.
Yeah, I do. I think you should have a cocktail to go with special time. But really, children are fascinated by it.
Yeah. That, like, you can create the space to, like, make something different.
But it doesn't take a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't. I mean, I often think, oh, I need to go away for a 7-day, 8-day retreat, but just try 8 minutes.
Rebecca's son is now 30 and lives in Oregon. He regularly sends her photos of pen and ink drawings. It's one way they stay connected. And she says she has this broad and deep community of friends back home in North Carolina. Tell me if this is too private, but I'm curious, because you mentioned that the friendship, the person you met at camp, that's been a recurring connection.
Yes.
How are you two in each other's lives now?
We're not. So she lives here. And for me, it didn't feel healthy and whole. It just didn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. It was too easy for us to make it about the past, make it about sex. It just wasn't where I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But love her. We'll always love her. I mean, gosh, what a history. What a story.
Yeah. I like that. How wild that you're in the same town.
Would you turn your cart if you saw her in the grocery store aisle?
No, because she'd run me down in the parking lot. She would come after me. No, don't run. When you meet your adversary, you have to act bigger, not run away. Well, I mean, there's some people, you know, if you run like you're prey, they're going to chase you. So, like, don't act like you're prey in the grocery store. Be the bear. That's my advice. My love advice. Be the bear.
That's Rebecca Allman, a witch in Carrboro, North Carolina. Her podcast is called Voices in the River. Death, Sex, and Money is produced by Slate. Please support the production of our show by becoming a member of Slate Plus. You'll not only support our work at Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and to all of the great shows that Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Dakota Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. Be a part of helping us build a solid foundation at Death, Sex, and Money's new home by subscribing to Slate Plus. Just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. This episode was produced by Cameron Drews. The rest of the Death, Sex, and Money team is Andrew Dunn and Zoe Azoulay. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer. Alicia Montgomery is Slate's head of audio. Thanks to Theo Balcom for helping make this episode happen. Our theme music is by the Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis. And if you're new to our show, welcome. We're so glad you're here. You can find us and follow us on Instagram at Death, Sex, Money. And you can find my weekly newsletter at annasale.substack.com. You can also reach us anytime with voice memos, pep talks, questions, critiques at our email address, deathsexmoney@slate.com. We love hearing from you. Well, now I feel like I have to do a general question of just, is there anything that you noticed either in our conversation that I didn't notice that happened?
Well, I think I sense that you're trying to make sense of it all, and I'm not sure it makes any sense. But besides that, I think it was lovely.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate.